a geological map of eastern Nebraska at the time, and really just kind of poking around. If I hadn't gone up this ravine, or the rains hadn't just washed out that skull, I'd have walked on by, and this would never have been found. He indicated a roofed enclosure nearby, which had become the main excavation site. Some 200 animals had been found lying together in a jumble. I asked him in what way it was a dumb place to hunt for bones. Well, if you're looking for bones, you really need exposed rock. That's why most paleontology is done in hot, dry places. It's not that there are more bones there, it's just that you have some chance of spotting them. In a setting like this, he made a sweeping gesture across the vast and unvarying prairie, you wouldn't know where to begin. There could be really magnificent stuff out there, but there's no surface clues to show you where to start looking. At first, they thought the animals were buried alive, and Voorhees stated as much in a National Geographic article in 1981. The article called the site a Pompeii of prehistoric animals, he told me, which was unfortunate because just afterward we realized that the animals hadn't died suddenly at all. They were all suffering from something called hypertrophic pulmonary osteodystrophy, which is what you would get if you were breathing a lot of abrasive ash, and they must have been breathing a lot of it because the ash was feet thick for hundreds of miles. He picked up a chunk of grayish, clay-like dirt and crumbled it into my hand. It was powdery but slightly gritty. Nasty stuff to have to breathe, he went on, because it's very fine but also quite sharp. So anyway, they came here to this watering hole, presumably seeking relief, and died in some misery. The ash would have ruined everything. It would have buried all the grass and coated every leaf and turned the water into an undrinkable gray sludge. It couldn't have been very agreeable at all. The BBC documentary had suggested that the existence of so much ash in Nebraska was a surprise. In fact, Nebraska's huge ash deposits had been known about for a long time. For almost a century, they had been mined to make household cleaning powders like Comet and Ajax. But curiously, no one had ever thought to wonder where all the ash came from. I'm a little embarrassed to tell you, Voorhees said, smiling briefly, that the first I thought about it was when an editor at the National Geographic asked me the source of all the ash, and I had to confess that I didn't know. Nobody knew. Voorhees sent samples to colleagues all over the western United States, asking if there was anything about it that they recognized. Several months later, a geologist named Bill Bonichson from the Idaho Geological Survey got in touch and told him that the ash matched a volcanic deposit from a place called Bruneau Jar Bridge in southwest Idaho. The event that killed the plains animals of Nebraska was a volcanic explosion on a scale previously unimagined, but big enough to leave an ash layer 10 feet deep, almost 1,000 miles away in eastern Nebraska. It turned out that under the western United States there was a huge cauldron of magma, a colossal volcanic hotspot which erupted cataclysmically every 600,000 years or so. The last such eruption was just over 600,000 years ago. The hotspot is still there. These days we call it Yellowstone National Park. We know amazingly little about what happens beneath our feet. It is fairly remarkable to think that Ford has been building cars and baseball has been playing World Series for longer than we have known that the Earth has a core. And of course the idea that the continents move about on the surface like lily pads has been common wisdom for much less than a generation. Strange as it may seem, wrote Richard Feynman, we understand the distribution of matter in the interior of the Sun far better than we understand the interior of the Earth. The distance from the surface of the Earth to the center is 3,959 miles, which isn't so very far. It has been calculated that if you sunk a well to the center and dropped a brick into it, it would take only 45 minutes for it to hit the bottom. Though at that point it would be weightless, since all the Earth's gravity would be above and around it rather than beneath it. Our own attempts to penetrate toward the middle have been modest indeed. One or two South African gold mines reach to a depth of 2 miles, but most mines on Earth go no more than about a quarter of a mile beneath the surface. If the planet were an apple, we wouldn't yet have broken through the skin. Indeed, we haven't even come close. Until slightly under a century ago, what the best-informed scientific minds knew about Earth's interior was not much more than what a coal miner knew. Namely, that you could dig down through soil for a distance, and then you'd hit rock, and that was about it. Then in 1906, an Irish geologist named R.D. Oldham, while examining some seismograph readings from an earthquake in Guatemala, noticed that certain shock waves had penetrated to a point deep within the earth and then bounced off at an angle, as if they had encountered some kind of barrier. From this, he deduced that the earth has a core. 3 years later, a Croatian seismologist named Andrija Morovicic was studying graphs from an earthquake in Zagreb when he noticed a similar odd deflection, but at a shallower level. He had discovered the boundary between the crust and the layer immediately below, the mantle. This zone has been known ever since as the Mohorovicic discontinuity, or MOHO for short. We were beginning to get a vague idea of the Earth's layered interior, though it really was only vague. Not until 1936 did a Danish scientist named Inge Lehmann, studying seismographs of earthquakes in New Zealand, discover that there were two cores, an inner one that we now believe to be solid, and an outer one, the one that Oldham had detected, that is thought to be liquid and the seat of magnetism. Just about the time that Lehmann was refining our basic understanding of the Earth's interior by studying the seismic waves of earthquakes, two geologists at Caltech in California were devising a way to make comparisons between one earthquake and the next. They were Charles Richter and Benno Gutenberg, though for reasons that have nothing to do with fairness, the scale became known almost at once as Richter's alone. It has nothing to do with Richter either. A modest fellow, he never referred to the scale by his own name, but always called it the magnitude scale. The Richter scale has always been widely misunderstood by non-scientists, though perhaps a little less so now than in its early days, when visitors to Richter's office often asked to see his celebrated scale, thinking it was some kind of machine. The scale is, of course, more an idea than an object, an arbitrary measure of the Earth's tremblings based on surface measurements. It rises exponentially, so that a 7.3 quake is 50 times more powerful than a 6.3 earthquake, and 2,500 times more powerful than a 5.3 earthquake. At least theoretically, there is no upper limit for an earthquake, nor come to that a lower limit. The scale is simply a measure of force, but says nothing about damage. A magnitude 7 quake happening deep